This is a long chapter, and I'm not going to repeat it, sort of the story after I've read it. So you might want a Bible in your hands. If you do, we have Bibles in the back row on the stands too. Grab one now and keep it open in Genesis chapter 34. So let's read the Bible in Genesis 34. From verse 1. Now, some of you are visiting us from a long way today, and this is a very rare occasion, very rare chance for you to come and worship with us. And of all the Bible passages to choose to land on, this is probably one you would have missed. But don't blame me, I didn't inspire the Bible, and I didn't put it here. And it's here, and we've got to look at it, because it's here for a purpose, and God wants us to study it. So we're going to do that. It's a terrible story. So let's read it. Genesis 34. Now Dinah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. When Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and raped her. But his heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. And Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get me this girl as my wife." And when Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the field with his livestock, so he kept quiet about it until they came home. Then Shechem's father Hamor went out to talk with Jacob. Now, Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they heard what had happened, and they were filled with grief and fury, because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. But Hamor said to them, "My son Shechem has had his heart set on your daughter. Please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us. Give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it." Then Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and I'll give you whatever you ask. May the price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like, and I'll pay whatever you ask me. Only give me the girl as my wife." Because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. They said to them, "We can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who is not circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us. We will give our consent to you on one condition only, that you become like us by circumcising all your males. Then we will give you our daughters and take your daughters for ourselves. We'll settle among you and become one people with you. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we'll take our sister and go." Their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. The young man who was the most honored of all his father's household lost no time in doing what they said, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city to speak to their fellow townsmen. "These men are friendly towards us," they said. There's a gentle irony there for those of you who read the rest of the passage. "These men are friendly towards us," they said. "Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But the men will consent to live with us as one people only on the condition that our males be circumcised as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their other animals become ours? So let us give our consent to them and they will settle among us." All the men went out of the city gate, agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in their houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites and Perizzites, the people living in this land. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed. But they replied, should he have treated our sister like a prostitute? I was once the main speaker, basically the only speaker, on a youth camp, a very large youth camp, in the western part of Brazil. And the young lad who was the sort of president of the youth group and was the sort of main leader, he was very young, quite young, to be taken on that responsibility. I can't remember exactly how old he was, but he's about 19. But organizing this large camp and doing it very effectively. And in fact, we shared a house together and on the edge of the camp and got to know him quite well. And I was very impressed by him. Clearly, a young man who had leadership stamped all over him. He was responsible, he was polite, he was caring. He was reliable, top guy, and well thought of, well loved by everyone. Anyway, the camp went very well, and I went home. Which I lived a long way from it. And about a year or two passed, and I met somebody from that part of Brazil again. And I asked after this lad, because I was keen to see how he was getting on. And the guy rolled his eyes to the ceiling. And so, yeah, I said, well, go on, tell me the bad news then. And then he told me the bad news. The lad had fallen for a non-Christian girl and started going out with her. And I don't know who seduced who or how it happened, but he got her pregnant. And the girl's brothers were a very rough lot, and they were furious that their sister had been dishonored, that their family had been dishonored. So they jumped him one night and beat him up very, very badly. He ended up in hospital. He was so ashamed and so brutalized by the whole thing, he dropped out of church altogether. And don't ask me how it ended, because that's as much as I know. That was maybe 30 years ago. But it was to me, I think, an introduction into what happens when sex and family honor and religion all get mixed up together. You get something horrific. So it's not difficult to believe the story of Dinah and Shechem and Dinah's brothers. Now, you might ask, why is this story in the Bible? It's in the Bible because it happened. The Bible doesn't have any intention of painting God's people as the good guys and the rest of the world as the bad guys. It doesn't work like that. The Bible's a very honest book. And it's not a book of sweetness and light and fairy stories. This is life. This is nature, human nature, red in tooth and claw. Question, how many times is God mentioned in this chapter? Well, I'll let you thumb your way through the chapter while I'm speaking, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to find God in this chapter at all. Now, I've always said that God is the hero of every Bible story, but it's difficult to be a hero of a Bible story you're not mentioned in. And the Bible, the biblical authors are not stupid. They send us messages. Does God approve of what the brothers did? The Bible often tells blood-curdling stories without comment. Leaves us to make up our own minds, to work things out for ourselves. It doesn't patronize us or condescend to us. The hints, it's often just hints which kind of give us the feel of a passage. In this one, this case, it comes in the very last verse of this chapter. Verse 31. The brothers replied to Jacob, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" And the chapter finishes in a question, a rhetorical question, really. It's kind of, what kind of answer is that? What kind of explanation is that? What kind of end to a story is that? There's no kind of explanation, no kind of end to the story. It's written like that deliberately because, you see, well, that's no answer to a very good question of what's going on. Clearly then, we're supposed to look at this story and raise our eyes to the ceiling and say it shouldn't be like that. It's the author's hint. "You didn't ask God, did you?" is probably written between every line in this story. You didn't ask God before you went and you did what you did. So, who's to blame? And this is quite a difficult question. Who's to blame? You could say if you're in the wrong place, you don't blame God if things go wrong. If you remember the story, if we go back to chapter 28, verses 20 to 22, Jacob makes a vow saying to God that if he comes back wealthy and with a family and blessed, he will come back to that place known as Bethel. It's a pretty dumb promise in many ways, but it's still a promise. And God has blessed him, and he's coming back to that place, rich and strong. You'd think he'd go to Bethel, but he's not in Bethel. He's in the land of the Hivites. In the next chapter, verse 1 of chapter 35, God has to remind him, "Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there and build an altar to the God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau." So God has to remind him, in a sense, "Jacob, you shouldn't be here in the first place. You should be in Bethel. You should have gone to Bethel, but you ended up here." So Jacob appears to be in the wrong place. Dinah, too, because her family's in the wrong place, she ends up in the wrong place. Now, how much to blame is she? It really depends which commentator you read, because the commentators cannot agree whether Dinah was the innocent victim or whether she brought this partly, at least, on herself. Back to chapter 34, verse 1. Dinah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. She went into the city. She went into the town to visit the pagan women there. Is she to blame for that? Possibly. Verse 2. And Shechem, saw her, took her, and raped her. Now, again, the biblical word here, the Hebrew word here translated, "he raped her," doesn't necessarily have to mean that. It can mean they went to bed together consensually. In fact, he lay with her. It's not 100% clear from the Hebrew original that it was a violation. If you go to verse 26, after this happens, Dinah is still staying in Shechem's house. So she has moved in with him. Now, was she kidnapped? Or did she choose to move in with him? You can argue this over the dinner table, if you like, Faith Cafe. I've swung between the two opinions. Times I say, no, Dinah, you know, she was part of this deal. And at times I think, no, she was the innocent victim. And I've kind of changed my view at least five times on this. So who am I to tell you what you should believe? What is clear is that King Hamar and his family are self-seeking. If you go to verse 21, it says, "These men are friendly towards us, as if. Let them live in our land and trade in it. Land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry us." It goes on to say that all their wealth we can filch it from them slowly, year by year. So he's in it for the money. He's not as altruistic as he's making out. He sees there's something to be gained from this. At no point, by the way, no point does he say, your God will be our God. Doesn't say that. There's no suggestion here that he's going to follow Jacob's God. They're still pagans. And they want him to interbreed with the people of God. And are there not alarm bells going off in your brain? This is not how it's going to be. This is not how it should be. It's gone wrong. And now what they're proposing is going to make it worse. So what's Jacob's part in all this? Well, if you remember, I've been telling you that Jacob, for the first part of his life, is treated as a bit of a comedy character. He's getting into the most incredible mess. He's getting duped by his father-in-law. And the biblical authors have got a sharp sense of humour, a sharp sense of irony, which they display in telling the story of Jacob, the first half of his life. But after his huge encounter with God, the night he has a name change from Jacob to Israel, which means one who wrestles with God, he finds God in a new and deeper way. He becomes a man of God. And the biblical authors stop treating him as a comedy character. And there's certainly nothing humorous about this. He's met with God. He's talked with God. He's learned to listen with God. But in this chapter, there's no God. He's had a deep experience of the Lord, but he doesn't seem to ask God's opinion. He just doesn't seek God's will at all in this chapter. In fact, he doesn't do anything at all. Leah, his daughter, is there in the city, in Shechem's house. And he says and does nothing. He waits for his sons to come back. Now, Dinah was the seventh and last child of Leah, the wife he didn't love that much. And there could be a sense here he's not valuing his daughter. Maybe he hasn't set her appropriate boundaries. Maybe he didn't say to her, Dinah, I don't trust these guys. You do not go into that city alone. In fact, it does sound rather adventurous, doesn't it? Going into the pagan city on your own. He kind of, having failed in that sense to set up the appropriate boundaries and see the problem on the horizon, he now abandons all responsibility. He does nothing till his headstrong sons come home. All he does really is wring his hands and complain. He is idle in his responsibility. But, you know, it can happen. He's become a godly man, but he's drifted. He's just kind of drifted. He's let things drift under him. He's let things get too involved with the pagan world. D.A. Carson, one of my favorite theologians and commentary writers, has a warning here. He says, we drift towards compromise and call it tolerance. We drift towards disobedience and call it freedom. We drift towards superstition and call it faith. We cherish the indiscipline of lost control and call it relaxation. We slouch towards prayerlessness and delude ourselves into thinking we have escaped legalism. We slide towards godlessness and convince ourselves we have been liberated. Jacob stopped praying. He's learned to pray. He's seen the power of prayer. He's been transformed by it. He's wrestled with God and told God he won't let him go until he's blessed, and he gets blessed. And God gets him out of a difficult situation. And now he's just drifted into trouble. And if Jacob has been guilty of allowing things to drift out of control, his sons, frankly, well, his sons are appalling. That throwaway rhetorical question in verse 31, should he have treated our sister like a prostitute? It shows that his sons really haven't thought this through. There's no suggestion that she was treated like a prostitute. That's the point. Their only excuse for what they do is a nonsensical excuse. They haven't got an excuse. They haven't got a reason. They know that they haven't done this the right way, but they just don't want to face reality. When Jacob comes to bless them later on, this is many years later, if you go to chapter 49, verses 5 to 8, he doesn't bless them. He actually curses Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly. It's too late, Jacob. They have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. Judah, your brother, it goes on to pray, talk about Judah in very different terms. So even in the family blessing at the end of Jacob's life, he curses Simeon and Levi. Is their concern for their sister or the family's so-called honour? That's my question. And there's no doubt when you read it, they don't have that much concern for Dinah. They feel that the family's honour has been offended. So what do they do? Verse 29, after they've attacked the city and they've killed all the men, killed all the soldiers, they carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in their houses. And again, there's a between the lines subtext there that they end up doing to those women what those women's what that man had done to their sister. Are they any better? They're no better. Truth is, they are no better. Please do not set them up as your spiritual heroes. In fact, don't set any man or woman up as your spiritual hero. Stick to Jesus. And again, do they consult God? No, in fact, they don't even consult their father. There's awful lack of consultation going on here. Isn't it depressing? I mean, we were so hyped up after last week when we were so thrilled with Jacob and how good he'd become and how serious a man of God he'd become. And what does he do? He buys a piece of land in Shechem. He doesn't go to Bethel where he promised to go. He just begins to take the easy option. What looks like the easy option. He puts his feet up, drifts into trouble. Do you struggle with this chapter? It's not a pleasant one, is it? In fact, it's one of many in the Old Testament. They're horrible chapters. They're not pleasant. I was just thinking about this. You know, Jesus knew the Old Testament. He quotes from the Old Testament. Jesus knew all these stories. What was Jesus' opinion? If we took Jesus to the side and said, Jesus, what is that about? Well, Jesus' opinion of all the violence in the Old Testament, I think you can work out from Matthew 26, verse 52. Put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to Simon Peter, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Jesus said, listen, if violence is your way of life, then violence will kill you. Violence will bring you down. Violence will destroy you. Blessed, says Jesus, are the peacemakers. Jesus looked at all those stories in the Old Testament. He said, that is a perfect example of how not to live. Vengeance, vendettas, revenge, retribution. Jesus said, throw it away. It'll only make your life miserable. And it's what happened. Simeon and Levi and the sons of Jacob end up becoming worse than the pagans they've just killed. And that's not how it should be. And how did it happen? They didn't choose to do that. They didn't set out to do that. They drifted spiritually till it happened. They were in the wrong place because they were too lazy to go where Jacob should have gone, which was Bethel. They weren't praying when they could have been praying. They weren't thinking. They weren't consulting. They weren't being open with each other. They weren't being open and honest and upright. And the whole thing becomes a massacre which stinks, which fouls the page. Just drifted. There was in America, there was many years ago, there was an aeroplane coming into land in the southern part of America. I think it might have been aiming for Florida. It was coming in over the swampland at night. And it was a clear night, but they were coming over the sea and over the swampland. There were no lights to guide them, nothing to show them where they were. And as they were preparing on their descent, they noticed that a light that should have been illuminated on the many dashboards on their jumbo jet wasn't a light. And they looked at it and they said, well, it's almost certainly the light bulb has blown. But that's okay, they carried spares. So they said, all we need to do is just take it out, put the new one in, that should be okay. So I think they had a flight engineer on the deck as well, flight deck. So they got the little light bulb ready just to take the old one out, but the old one was stuck. 50p light bulb. And it was stuck. And the pilot and the co-pilot both began fiddling with a 50p light bulb to change it. And while they were doing that mess in concentrating, one of them accidentally, with his knee, knocked the autopilot off. And the plane began to sink lower and lower, and they didn't know. They thought they were still at the proper height. When the plane got too low, a little warning sound, buzzer sounded. But they didn't recognize, they didn't notice. They were so busy talking, arguing, laughing, trying to get the 50p light bulb out, they didn't hear the low altitude warning. And it ended up the plane simply plowed into the ground, and hundreds of people were killed. All for a 50p light bulb. Reliably informed that can't happen again. But it's a slow drift. You know, they were drifting slowly to their destruction. But they didn't realize. They didn't realize. They didn't see it coming. And Jacob and his family, they were drifting towards a disaster. And they didn't realize. They didn't stop to ask God, can I just suggest that you do that? If you're in a situation that's difficult, why don't you stop and ask God? Romans 12:19, our last Bible verse. Don't take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. It could have been different, but it wasn't. Because they drifted into it.